This is the Andy Pollin Hour on Washington's new home for sports. ESPN 630, the sports capital.
Finishing the week with two today. Tony Kornheiser's out until Monday. And baseball season is going to resume tonight, so we'll talk to Mark Zuckerman in about 20 minutes. Mark has covered the Nationals since they came to town from Montreal in 2005, and he now works for Masson. Back from a little vacation himself on the All-Star break, and we'll talk about what's ahead for the Nats, who have a little bit of a hill to climb. They're five games under 500, six games out of first place, but because the Mets haven't run away with anything, Ronald Acuna Jr. got hurt for Atlanta. He's out for the year, so that will hurt them, and the Phillies really haven't shown any consistency. They're right in it, and we'll talk about what's ahead in the coming weeks. They're playing shorthanded, too. I mean, they've got two backup catchers on the roster now. They played most of the season without Steven Strasburg, and we'll ask Zuckerman if he thinks that Strasburg will be back soon. Davey Martinez said, I believe, right before the break that he was due for a rehab start in the minor league. So if that takes place in the next couple of weeks, you could possibly see Strasburg back for the end of the season. Who knows how he's going to look? Who knows if he can stay healthy? But if they have what they had from Strasburg back in 2019, look, they're in it without him for most of the season. So if he can come back and give them something, that may give them a chance to get a wild card or maybe even win the division. Who knows? But the real story this morning is just when you thought it was safe, it's not. And so many things now have piled up in the last 48 hours that you have to grip the steering wheel tightly as you drive and say, whew, we're really not out of the woods here. I've been going to the gym for the last couple of months without a mask. We've been going to restaurants, which are reopened fully. The City Open yesterday said that for tennis, 100% capacity. Nats Park is 100% capacity. Same for Camden Yards. But, even with vaccinated people, we're seeing more cases of COVID, including Rich Eisen of the NFL Network, who tweeted out yesterday that he's been vaccinated, had the double vaccine, and he's got COVID. You can get it. Bradley Beal, not sure whether he's had the vaccine or not, but his Olympic dreams go down the tubes. He's not going to be able to play. He's been placed in COVID protocol, and I guess it's serious enough that he's not even going to be able to go with the team to Tokyo. The first game isn't until the 25th. Theoretically, he could have spent 10 days in COVID protocol and made it to the Olympics, but that's not going to happen. He's off the team. And you have now the Yankees, who had to postpone last night's game with the Red Sox because of six players testing positive, or at least they expect six to test positive. One of them is Aaron Judge. And L.A. County yesterday said, forget it, you got to wear masks inside now. We're rescinding what we said a couple of weeks ago, that everything was now open. Now you got to wear masks. It's, it's a relapse, if you want to call it that, or it's like the car that's almost reached the top of the hill and you couldn't quite get there, and now you're seemingly rolling back down the other side of the hill. It's not good. It's not good at all. We'll get to Beal more in a second. This was Buster Olney this morning on our morning show here on ESPN 630. He was in New York last night for this Red Sox-Yankees game, and he was on the field as the players were told, forget it, you got to leave. We got positive tests, and they're expecting more once they get the results today, and what this is going to mean for baseball moving forward. Here's Buster with Alan Hahn and Keyshawn Johnson this morning here on ESPN 630.
Aaron Judge was at the All-Star game, and so just an hour after Major League Baseball announced that they had postponed last night's game, Red Sox are taking batting practice on the field. Alex Cora standing behind the cage, Tim Hire, their hitting coach, is there, and three of their All-Stars are told as they're leaving the field, you have to go get tested right now because you were around Aaron Judge. And you would assume that that conversation is going to be happening in clubhouses all across baseball today. I don't think, as we sit here this morning, we have a full understanding exactly what the scope of this is. And if you're Major League Baseball, you're hoping it's just limited to that one clubhouse. We'll see.
Buster, will we see more come out today?
Yes. The test results from yesterday with the Yankees three position players, Aaron Judge, Kyle Gashioka, and Gio Urshela, they'll get those results back. They'll also get those first results back from the Red Sox All-Stars who were tested yesterday. Xander Bogaerts, Rafael Devers, J.D. Martinez. And at that point, Major League Baseball can make a decision on whether or not today's game is played, if the rest of the series is going to be affected in any way, or maybe they'll rearrange a doubleheader. And then they should start to get some of the results back from testing that resulted from the contact tracing done after they got this information yesterday.
Does Major League Baseball plan to make any at all, Buster, significant changes as we speak?
Not that I heard specifically yesterday. Now, I will tell you that this situation ramped up, I think, attention on this around baseball. For example, Alex Cora, when the Red Sox held their team meeting yesterday, told his players, look, we've accomplished so much this year. We need to be diligent as we go forward. We need to be careful. You know, there was a sense within the Red Sox clubhouse earlier this year that they had done a really good job with this. They want to continue that. I would expect that type of conversation is going to go on around clubhouses all around baseball today to have this after seeing what, you know, this rash of at least six cases with the Yankees.
Now remember, Aaron Judge is at the All-Star game and he's there with Juan Soto and he's there with Max Scherzer. He's there with Kyle Schwarber, who of course is hurt, but Trey Turner also there. Three of the most important players, the Nationals, who are currently healthy, and Schwarber can get back from that hamstring injury in a relatively short period of time. Those are their four best players, and they were exposed to Aaron Judge. You know, Judge could be out for 10 days, and depending on what the tests show today with those four players, Nats could be missing all three of them. And that could really, you know, tube their season. They're on the brink right now. Five games under 500, six games out of first place. Without those guys, oh, my God. So what looked like a situation where we go, okay, we're out of the woods here. Everybody feeling better, you know, going to weddings with the full crowds there and hanging out at ball games and going back to the bars and shaking hands and life is back. No, it's not. And this is a warning that we're getting from sports. And if you look at the news reports, there's an uptick in cases. There's the variants that they're talking about now. So it's not a good situation. And look at what it's done to Bradley Beal, who waited 10 years for this opportunity. He joined Team USA's program in college when he was at Florida for the 1 year, and he's waited his turn. He's been snubbed for All-Star games. He's been snubbed for All-NBA. He's finally gotten both of those honors and finally got the opportunity to play on the Olympic team, and now that's not going to happen. And according to Bam Adebayo, one of his teammates, he's asymptomatic. He's not even feeling the effects of it, but because he is tested positive, he can't go. And we don't know whether or not he's had the vaccine, or, you know, even if he has, that's no guarantee, as we saw with Rich Eisen, that you won't get the virus. So that's back, and that's a very scary thing as we move forward in the world of sports. Looking forward to going to some games this summer, hoping to go to the Orioles and the Nationals next weekend in Camden Yards, and I don't know. I mean, at this point, what looked like a pretty safe situation as the week started, as we wrap it up, looks like a very, very serious situation, which is going on in sports. Some news out of what's happening with the Wizards. And you remember when Tommy Shepard held an end-of-season news conference, or actually it was the news conference where he announced that Scott Brooks wasn't coming back. He said that he would like to have a new coach in place by the time free agency starts. And that is going to be August the 2nd. So we're 17 days away from the start of free agency. And while I guess he doesn't feel like it's urgent to have a coach in place for the draft, which is, you know, a few days before that, time is running out. And according to The Athletic, the front runner for the job now is Wes Unseld Jr., which is interesting. He's got some, obviously, the name connection to the organization. His father is the most important person in the history of the franchise. There's no question about it. He's the greatest player. He coached. He was the GM. He was not very good at either of those jobs, coach or GM. But he stayed a part of the organization for 35 years, something like that. And his son did not reach his level as a player. Wes Unseld Jr. played at Johns Hopkins, which is a Division III program. But he got into the coaching business, and he worked first, I guess, as the video coordinator for the Wizards, moved up to assistant coach, was there until 2011, until 10 years ago, bumped around a little bit with other teams. He's been with the Denver Nuggets, and according to The Athletic, he is the number one choice for this job. And I think, you know, when you look at that, there is some pressure with that. But the way the world moves along, you know, what people associate the team with, I don't know how much of it is Wes Unseld anymore. You know, there was one time where he was, you know, ubiquitous. He was the person that the franchise was connected to. When you think of Washington Bullets, you think of Wes Unseld. But they've been Wizards longer than they were the Washington Bullets. And Wes has been out of the picture for a long time. Sadly, he died last year, relatively young. He was in his early 70s. And, you know, you also look at what he did with the organization. He was not a good coach. He was not. And he was not a good general manager. He was a great person, a great ambassador for the team. But those jobs he did not do well at. He got the Bullets to the playoffs once, I think, and as a GM, really didn't make any groundbreaking moves, and then was part of really a panic move by Abe Pollin. You may remember this. Chris Webber was stopped on a traffic stop, and he would not roll down his window because he allegedly had marijuana in the car and was arrested for that. And right before the league shut down, there was a lockout. Abe ordered Wes Unseld to trade Chris Webber, and he traded him for an aging Mitch Richmond. He traded young and big for old and small, and it was one of the really bad moves that they made. And there were a couple others along the way that were not very good. They had a chance to keep Juwan Howard, and they lowballed him. He had an offer of over $100 million to go to the Miami Heat, and they offered him $83 million. So, you know, what are you going to do? $20 million, you're going to go. And he left, and then the signing was overturned by the commissioner, and he came back here. So, you know, what he's going to be as a coach, who knows? But he's been around the NBA his whole life, and there is a feeling, I guess, certainly in the organization that they like what they see in Wes Unseld Jr. It's not a sexy hire, even though he's got a classic name, but we'll see. I mean, it didn't work out with Scott Brooks. Scott Brooks had experience. He got a big contract, you know, $7 million a year. That's not going to happen with Wes Unseld Jr., but we'll see what pans out with him as he's expected to get the job, and I would expect him to get the job soon since, again, Tommy Shepard said they hope to have a coach in place by the time free agency starts. From the Washington football team, and this ties in more with what we're talking about here with the COVID, there is a report from the Associated Press that about 70% of NFL players have been vaccinated. About 70%. Washington is one of four teams that is below 50%. Arizona, Indianapolis, and the Chargers are the others with less than 50%. Come on. What's happening here? The team was very good last year. You have to say they followed protocol very well. They had only two players who tested positive during the season. One was Matt Ioannidis, who was already on injured reserve, and Javon Leak, who was a practice squad running back. So that had really no effect on the team last year. And they've been, you know, good at following it. But, you know, you got a coach who's recovering from cancer, so he's susceptible. A coach who has made an effort to educate the players about the need to get vaccinated. There's also protocols in the league which change based on how many players you've had vaccinated. So when they go on the road, they're going to have to stay in a hotel room. I mean, I would assume that if they go to training camp in about a week and a half and players have not been vaccinated, the veterans will start to put the pressure on some of these guys to do it. Though you also have Montez Sweat, who came out and said, well, I don't see the need to get vaccinated. I haven't gotten COVID. Well, yeah, but you're not quite understanding here what's needed. So, that kind of thinking has to change. And whether you want to make this political or not, the need is there. And you could say, oh, those who've been vaccinated have gotten COVID again. Yes, it does happen. But if you don't have people getting COVID because they've been vaccinated,
you're less likely to have more contact with those who do, if you follow what I'm saying here. Also, what they say about the vaccination is if you get it, it's less likely to be serious. Like Chris Paul had the vaccination, he got COVID, he went into protocol and has been fine, apparently. I mean, you know, he didn't have a good game last game, doesn't mean it's any effect of COVID. So this is baffling to me with the way that Ron Rivera has changed the culture. He hasn't changed all of it, and you got a team now that's lagging behind and needs to get vaccinated. The other Washington football team note is Brandon Scherff, who is going to play under the franchise tag for the second straight year. He's going to make $18 million this year. There will not be a third year because the money goes up 44%, which means he would be due $26 million to play right guard next year. And that's just not going to make any sense whatsoever. So I would think this is his last year with the team. He's going to be 30 years old in December, hasn't played a full season since 2016. Now, when he plays, he's terrific. He played 13 games last year, had only one penalty, a false start, and allowed only one sack, which was a loss of 5 yards, and was named first-team All-Pro. First time that's happened for a Washington football player since Matt Turk in 1996. He's a great player, but you're paying your right guard $18 million. Your quarterback is due $10 million, Ryan Fitzpatrick, where the average salary for the starting quarterbacks in the NFL is $18 million. So your right guard is being paid what the average is of starting quarterbacks, and that just doesn't make economic sense. But they also are looking at, you know, whether or not you sign a guy who, again, is going to be 30 years old, who has a history of injuries, to a long-term contract when you've got a bunch of deals coming up, like Charles Leno, who's expected to start at left tackle. He's on a one-year deal. Jonathan Allen, who is emerging as a great young player and a leader for this team, his rookie deal is going to be up. Logan Thomas, who came in on the cheap last year, has one more year under that deal, and then he's going to hit free agency. So they got to start to pay some guys. Terry McLaurin is going to be eligible in another year, maybe 2 years. So they're looking down the line, and they're saying, do we want to invest this much money in a guy who's, yes, he's really good, but he has injuries, and it's a guard. You know, again, how much do you – it used to be a position that was severely underpaid. But they've started to realize that these very expensive quarterbacks, they need healthy blockers, and they need really good blockers. And he's good. He's really, really good. But $18 million makes him the highest paid guard in the league. And for a team that has some other needs right now, that doesn't make the most economic sense. But they're going to ride it out this year and see how it goes. Mark Zuckerman's going to join me next. We'll talk about the Nats as they begin the second half of the season tonight against San Diego. You're listening to the Andy Polin Hour, ESPN 630. For Tony today as well, from 11 to 12, Nationals begin the second half of the season tonight against San Diego. Mark Zuckerman, who has covered the team since they came here from Montreal in 2005 and now is with Matheson, joins me now, fresh off a little R&R for himself. I saw on Facebook you did a little fishing. I hope, though, you threw that fish back. Wasn't very big.
That was... Honestly, Andy, that was the first time I've been fishing since I was a kid, and I caught it in about 3 minutes. I had no idea it could be that easy. threw it right back. So we had a nice little break.
Yeah, and of course, there's the one that got away, which was, you know, like 4 feet long, right?
Of course.
Exactly. So here we are, second half of the season. I think last time we talked about the Nats being sellers, and then they got real hot. Kyle Schwarber went on an amazing tear. He got hurt, and the team fizzled out as they headed to the All-Star break. But it's doable. They're 5 games under .500. They're 6 games out of first place. And with the trade deadline about 2 weeks away, I don't think there's any chance they're going to be sellers, or will they?
I think they would have to completely fall apart here in the next 2 weeks. And, you know, not that that's impossible. You know, it could happen. Mm-hmm. But barring that, yeah, I think as long as they just kind of hold serve here and are still within striking distance, I think they're going to at least not be sellers. Now, will they be big-time buyers? I don't know. That's up to Mike Rizzo and maybe even more importantly up to ownership how much they want to commit here. But it's all still there for the taking. You know, they survived that stretch before the All-Star break against a really tough competition. Now It's three with the Padres, but after that, the schedule eases up a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, these next 2 weeks are huge for them. If they can get to July 30th and be right around the 500 mark and maybe it picked up a game or two on the Mets, I think they're right in the middle of this thing, and I'm curious to see how aggressive they are in trying to address some of their needs.
Of course, the big thing, if they want to talk themselves into not being sellers, is the injuries. And the big one, and the one they've missed most of the year, is Steven Strasburg. I thought Davey Martinez mentioned just before the break that he was going to get a rehab start in the minor leagues. Is there anything scheduled for that?
No, hopefully we're going to learn more today when we get to the ballpark. So he did face hitters in, I guess, a simulated game, you'd call it, over the weekend in San Francisco. And that's a good time for, you know, good news. The first time he had faced anybody in quite a while. So now it seems like it's just a matter of building the arm back up and getting to a point that you can go, you know, five innings and 75, 80 pitches, something like that. So, I mean, they've slow played this all along. They've said from the beginning that they aren't going to put him out there until they're confident he's 100% and ready to go. But, yeah, that is the biggest thing to me. Over the next 3 months, that is going to help determine whether they actually have a shot at this or not.
Mm-hmm.
This team is supposed to win behind its great starting pitch, and so far that has not been the case. They have Max Scherzer, who's been great. Steven Strasburg's been hurt, and Patrick Corbin has been pretty bad, to be honest. He's got the highest ERA in the NL now among all the qualifiers.
Yeah.
So if this thing is going to happen, if they're going to turn it around, to me, Strasburg and Corbin are maybe number one and number two in terms of most important players on the roster. They're going to have to help do something differently than what they did in the first half if this team is going to turn it around.
You know, the thing about Strasburg, and you know this as well as anyone, aside from last year where he only pitched, I guess, five innings, with all the injuries he's had over the years, he's had a sizable number of starts almost every year, hasn't he?
Yeah, they're really, other than the Tommy John recovery, mm-hmm. and then like you said last year, he's always been over 20-plus starts
yeah.
a year. You know, it's been little things. Knock on wood, he's really avoided the big major arm and shoulder and elbow injuries since the initial Tommy John. They've been more these nagging things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what makes it so frustrating to everyone, including himself, is that this isn't like, oh, his arm hurts. This is, you know, a neck issue that causes bad mechanics. We saw the velocity drop and all that. But, I mean, he desperately wants to be out there and contributing, and so far, they haven't been able to do it. Now, you know, hopefully this is the last time you have to deal with this, at least this year, and that he comes back and is good. I mean, the other thing about him, I've said this over and over again, the only times in his career that he has been ineffective on the mound is because he was hurt,
mm-hmm.
or a couple of times when he was tipping his pitches. He's never just, like, actually been bad. If he's healthy and he's on the mound and he's not tipping his pitches, he's always been really, really good. So I guess you can look at that and say, okay, if he just gets back on the mound, hopefully he's going to return to being his old self. But, I mean, it's been a while.
Yeah.
He's barely pitched the last 2 years, so do we really know? And when we last saw him, he's thrown 90 miles an hour, and that's just not who he is. So are we confident that when he does return, he's going to return to his old self? I don't know the answer to that. We just haven't seen him. We haven't spoken to him either in quite a while.
Also,
so, yeah. Hopefully we're a couple weeks away from finding out.
Yeah, and also of a starting concern, John Lester, who came back from COVID, looked pretty good. He's looked bad recently. How stable is his position in the rotation?
Well, he's survived to this point because of the other injury.
Yeah.
They haven't had more than five healthy starters, but they're getting close to that point now. So Eric Fetty is back. Joe Ross went on the IL right before the break with a little bit of an elbow issue, but they seemed confident at the time that he'd only miss one start. So he may be back here within the week. You know, they've announced the rotation for the weekend. It's Fetty, Corbin, and Scherzer. They haven't announced who's after that. And that's going to be the question. Does Lester get another start? He's really been bad. And more than anything, he's just not giving them innings. I mean, that's what they were counting on from him.
Mm-hmm.
Six innings every time out there. And he's struggling to get through four right now. And that's just not going to last. So if Ross is better and is good to go, and Paolo Espino, who nobody knew about coming into the season, but he's been very effective for them in whatever role they've asked him, ultimately, if they believe he gives them a better chance to win, they're going to have to make a decision with Lester pretty soon. And I know he's a big-name guy, a veteran. Everybody loves him. I mean, he's a good teammate. He's doing everything he can. But he's getting close to the end of the road here. And unless he can start showing them he can give them five or six quality innings, it's going to be hard to justify him taking the mound over the other guys that we just talked about.
Yeah, Espino is such a great story because the goal of every pitcher, it seems, in baseball today is to throw it as hard as you can. Here's a 34-year-old career minor leaguer who throws junk, and maybe he's just the right guy to throw in the mix that he throws off the hitters who we're used to seeing those fastballs all the time.
Yeah, I mean, as a former junk ball right-hander myself, I love it. It's why I always loved watching Leivon Hernandez pitch, just
yeah.
Because I love seeing guys who do it differently than the others, and it doesn't have to be power.
Yeah.
The pitching is about changing speeds, it's about location, it's about throwing off the hitter's timing, and he's done a remarkable job at that. Now, he got hit a little bit around in his last start against the Giants, and you do worry with a guy like that, that as teams start to get more of a look at him, they get a book on him, they start to figure out what he's doing, and he's not such a surprise anymore. So we'll see how long he can keep this up. I hope he can, because like I said, it's a great story, and I love watching him pitch. But that's among the reasons, like, let's not just assume that he's in the rotation the rest of the way, because what we saw here may be a mirage. As much as we want to believe this is legit, you don't get to age 34 and have barely pitched in the big leagues without there being a reason for that.
Yeah, no question.
So let's see. But regardless, he's done everything they could ask him, even if it ends up in the bullpen. It's been a great help to the team because he's been willing to do whatever they need for him.
Speaking of the bullpen, and we're talking to Mark Zuckerman, who covers the Nats for Madsen, has Austin Voth moved into that potential closer role there, the way that they've been using him lately?
Well, they've put him into some higher leverage spots, for sure.
Yeah.
And for the most part, he's delivered. It hasn't always been there. But they talk about another guy who just, as a starter, just really failed. He just could not get through the lineup more than once. So they tried him in the bullpen, and so far, so good. Now, I mean, Brad Hand has been lights out, especially since he had that little hiccup earlier in the year. Daniel Hudson is back now. So they have their two experienced veterans at the end of the bullpen. What they need is at least one or two guys to set them up. And Voth is a candidate for that. Kyle Finnegan is a candidate for that. Tanner Rainey is back on the IL again. We're not entirely sure when he's going to be back. I still think that's one area they could look to improve at the deadline here coming up. It doesn't cost a lot to get a reliever, especially, you know, a non-closer type, that's a setup man. I'll be curious to see what Mike Rizzo does. We know they've done that before. That's how they got Daniel Hudson. Maybe try to bolster that group without having to give up a big-time prospect. But, you know, they need three, four, five guys they can trust. We know all this. In the past, Davies had one or two relievers he could trust. It would be really nice if he had three, four, or five that he could trust, because the rotation hasn't been as good. And they are going to need innings, and they can't run these guys into the ground.
More on injuries. You glance at the roster. You see catcher Trez Barrera and Jackson Reitz. I said, no, I want to see the major league roster. No, that's it right now, because both catchers are out, right? Yan Gomes and Alex Avila are either close to coming back?
So Avila, hopefully, and we may even find out today that he could be back, because he's past the 10 days. And you remember, he had to play second base in one game when everything was a disaster. And he wound up straining, and I've never heard this one before, he strained both calf muscles.
What?
Not just one, but both, from playing second base, which I suppose it's like the equivalent of you or I if we go out and you know, play a full game of tackle football for the first time in years.
Yeah.
And how do you feel the next morning? You're sore all over the place.
I was just going to say, I retired from those office games years ago exactly because of that. So, yes,
right.
I understand that.
Right. So I think he woke up sore the next morning. He's like, well, I can't play for a little while.
Yeah.
So we got to put him on the IL. So hopefully he's ready to go now. He's able to come back. Gomes hurt his oblique right before the break, and that's a scary one because those can take a while. And he has been so important to them. I've said on my podcast with Al Galdi, the Nats chat, that Trey Turner is the, you know, number one most important player on the team. And I think you see the difference when he's not there versus when he is there. But I think you can make the case that Yan Gomes is number two on that list of the guy they can least afford to lose because of what he's meant to them behind the plate, and really this year what he meant to them at the plate. He's been fantastic for them.
Yeah.
So they really have to hope that that's not a serious oblique injury and that he's back soon. Hopefully they have Avila at least for the, you know, so they have a major league catcher here for the next week or so, but then the hope is that Gomes won't be too far behind.
All right. Now, other injuries, Trey Turner came back, so I guess the finger's not a problem. The outfield, they're still down an outfielder. Aren't they having to play Gerardo Parra pretty much on a regular basis? What's the situation there?
Yeah, so it's been Parra. It's been Andrew Stevenson, who's now back at the minors. It's been Josh Harrison, has been in left field some. because of the new second baseman, Alcides Escobar. Yeah, I mean, they need Schwarber back. And, you know, he's still got a ways to go. That was a significant hamstring injury.
Mm-hmm.
But he went to the All-Star game and you know, didn't play, but he was participating in all the activities and things. So, you know, I think we're still talking weeks for him. But if he could be back by August, that makes a huge difference because obviously he, you know, carried them for about 3 weeks there like we've never seen before. And but that's another area that maybe they do have to address in, at the trade deadline. Not necessarily for a big bat, but somebody to help cover the load for a while here because they're really stretched thin with their depth. Harrison, who was their everyday second baseman, is now becoming not their everyday left fielder, but he's playing there a lot.
Right.
They've got the, you know, Escobar, who they just picked up at second. They need some more quality depth there, even when Schwarber comes back, to help bolster the bench.
Yeah, I mean, that, and that, the bench is, you look at the bench and you see names that you're not used to seeing in there, and that tells you just how many injuries they've had. Like Alcides Escobar, he was always in the Kansas City's minor league system a few weeks ago, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, he was a starter for them back when they won the World Series, but
yeah,
he hadn't played in the big leagues in 3 years.
Yeah.
And they just acquired him. Now, he's done a nice job, but I mean, long term, is he the answer? Probably not.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what we're seeing here. They have, when they're healthy, they have the star power to compete with anybody, but their depth is really lacking, and they do not have many guys from their system who are big league caliber they can call up, and I think that's what's been exposed more than anything this season.
Yeah, I mean, this, and that's, that makes that whole thing we were talking about with buying and selling. At some point, they're going to have to be sellers, but the way the division has shaped up this year, it almost feels like what happened with the football team, that nobody's running away with it. So, you know, even though you're five games under 500, you're really very much in it at this point, so why be sellers?
Right, and I think they look at a couple things. One, that the Mets have not taken off,
yeah,
obviously, and that's helped. The Braves are really hurt. Acuna's out for the year. Ozuna's out for the year. Soroka, who's supposed to be their number one starter, is out. So they don't look great. The Phillies have all kinds of issues themselves. So, yeah, the division is still there for the taking. And I think, on top of it all, if you're Mike Rizzo, you look at this and you say, we still have Max Scherzer for at least the rest of this year.
Mm-hmm.
Potentially Strasburg when he comes back. Soto, Turner, Schwarber, Zimmerman, Bell. I mean, you still have some big-name guys. And you say, is this really a rebuilding situation? Now, I get why some people would say in the long run, yeah, eventually they have to think in those terms. But it's not a complete stretch to envision a scenario where they do play really well the second half. They win 88 to 90 games and sneak into the playoffs. And then who knows what happens.
Yep.
At that point. Now, you know, they're not as good as they were 2 years ago, obviously. But the division is such that they can afford to make a run at this and at least push off that rebuilding for another year or two.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me hit you with one more thing, and I know you haven't been out to the park and talked to anybody about this, but this flared up last night with the cancellation of the Red Sox and the Yankees. We've already seen that at the beginning of the season with the Nats and thought maybe we were past it. What's your sense of where they are now in baseball as a whole, and certainly with the Nats, who had their issue with this, fears of more cancellations, more postponements, more dealing with COVID as we go into these last couple of months of the season?
Yeah, as much as we all wish this wasn't on our radar anymore, it still is, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the good news, the Nats crossed the 85% vaccination threshold a while back, so they are one of the vast majority of teams have done it. There are a few that have not.
Yeah.
And I think the Red Sox are one that I heard of that are not. The Yankees are. And it does show you can still test positive. Now, this happened to Eric Fetty. He was vaccinated. He tested positive, never had symptoms. But he wound up missing like 4 weeks because of it, because of the time to be cleared and then the time to build his arm back up. So it can cost you. Now, they fortunately didn't have others that were testing positive as well. They didn't have to cancel games that time around. Obviously, the first week of the season, they did. That, to me, is the scary thing about what just happened with the Yankees, is that I thought we were at a point now where if one or two players test positive, they can remove them from the equation and the rest of the team is good. But the fact that they canceled that game and who knows what's going to happen the rest of the weekend with them, that says to me they're still concerned about it spreading. And that's a problem. That's the biggest fear, and that's what we thought we were past, and we're not there yet.
Yeah.
I think in the Nats' case, knock on wood, they should be good because so many of them have been vaccinated. But it is a reminder that we're not past this yet, either at baseball or across the side.
Yeah, and also, it's a good thing maybe they play in the National League and that Aaron Judge is one of those who tested positive, and at least they were in another locker room, their best players, you know, Turner and Soto and Max. And so, but I guess they'll all be tested today, and who knows how that's going to come out. So.
Sure, yeah. And you know, you hold your breath every 2 days when they get tested, and they hope that they don't get a ding on any of them.
Yeah.
You have to place somebody on the COVID IL. These things have come out of nowhere sometimes. We haven't seen them always coming. I'm sure they are concerned. I know they have been tested, and you know, we'll see what happens moving forward. But like I said, I think the Nats feel like they are in a good position because of the vaccination rate. Aside from that one thing with Fetty, everything's been fine for them since the initial first week of the season issue they had. And hopefully this is the end of it, but like I said, it's not over yet, and we have to remember that, you know, these are still going to be factors that everybody's got to pay attention to the rest of the way.
Fingers crossed. Always good to talk to you. Thanks so much, Mark.
Hey, my pleasure, Andy.
It's Mark Zuckerman, who does great work for Masson, and you can follow him at Mark Zuckerman. And he often gets confused with Mark Zuckerberg. He's not Mark Zuckerberg, but he has really funny responses when people say angry things to him on Twitter. So you can follow him just for the yucks for that. Coming up, it was 80 years ago today that Jolton Joe DiMaggio set a record that many believe will never be broken. We'll get to that as we continue. It's the Andy Pollin Hour, ESPN 630. In for Tony as well today from 11 to 12. I'm going to play some of the Cam Newton interview from yesterday on our morning show. Said some very interesting things, and he's a very interesting story in that, you know, 5 years ago, he was in the conversation with Brady and Aaron Rodgers and the great quarterbacks in the league. He had taken Carolina to the Super Bowl, and he was the MVP of the league. And now he's playing for relative peanuts in the NFL. His second year in a row, he signed a one-year contract with New England. Many didn't even think he'd be back. He struggled last year after coming back from COVID. And he is signed up and ready to go, and said some things about the signing of Mac Jones, or the drafting of Jones in the first round at Alabama, which might surprise you. So we'll play some of that in the next hour. Also, a little bit of a conversation that Trey Mancini had with Dan Patrick yesterday about being a cancer survivor and what he went through. And that's another concern with now Aaron Judge testing positive and Trey Mancini being in the same locker room with him as part of the American League All-Stars, and Mancini playing in the Home Run Derby and all that. What does that mean? I'm sure he'll be tested when he gets back, and you keep your fingers crossed on that. So we're back into real scary times here, and I don't know how many of you expected that. I was beginning to exhale, and not so much anymore. Anyway, it was 80 years ago today that Joe DiMaggio extended his hitting streak to 56 games. He had three hits, including a home run against the Cleveland Indians, and it looked like the streak was never going to end. In fact, DiMaggio, who we found out later in a really good book that was written by Richard Ben Kramer about 20 years ago, he loved money. He was a money hoarder. And he did things. I'll give you a quick story on DiMaggio before I launch into this. Remember when we had the earthquake in San Francisco at the 1989 World Series? And DiMaggio was in his seat at the game, and the earthquake subsided, and people inside the park, to be fair, really didn't know the damage outside, the amount of carnage that was going on, including the bridge collapse and the power and all the horrible things that happened there. But in the ballpark, it felt okay after the earthquake passed. And DiMaggio said, well, why don't they just play the game? And then a moment or so later, he found out that there had been a fire in his home. So he rushed out of the ballpark. Somebody had driven him there, and they drove to his house, and he goes running into the house, which the fire apparently had been a minor one, so he could get into the house. But he goes running upstairs, and he comes down with this enormous trash bag. And somebody says to him, oh, Mr. DiMaggio, I'll take that from you. No, you won't, because what was in the bag was $800,000 in cash. He would do autograph signings, and so he didn't have to pay taxes. He would take cash for it. So he loved cash, he loved money, and had he extended the hitting streak to 57 games, He had an endorsement waiting for him from Heinz 57 that he was going to endorse them, and he would have gotten $10,000, which was a lot of money in 1941. And he was not happy about that, believe me. But the day the streak was stopped, the next day, two great plays at third base by Ken Keltner. And years later, DiMaggio recalled how that streak came to an end.
We generally walked to the ballpark from the Cleveland Hotel to the municipal grounds, which is only about a six-block walk. However, we decided to take a cab this particular day, and as entering the cab, the fellow looked over at me and he says, aren't you Joe? And I says, yes. He says, you know, I got a feeling you're going to be stopped tonight. It was a night game, and Lefty liked to climb all over the fellow. He felt very bad about the whole incident throughout that night because he had a felt the jinx was put upon me. We started a little bit of a rally one inning, and they brought in Jim Bagby, a relief pitcher, and there was a man on first base, and I was at bat with one out, and I hit a ball to the left of Lou Boudreau, who was managing the ball club, who was playing shortstop. And as going to field the ball took a bad hop, and he got his glove up in time and threw to second base and completed the double play, and that's how that streak was broken.
And as you heard in that famous Les Brown song, Goodbye Streak, DiMaggio, Joe DiMaggio. The crazy thing is, he hit 16 straight more games. After his streak was stopped, he had a hitting streak of 16. So DiMaggio hit safely in 72 of 73 games during this streak. The numbers that he put together, it was from May 15th to July 16th, the numbers that he had, 408 batting average, 15 home runs, 55 runs batted in, 56 runs scored. He had 200, and this is the most amazing thing with the numbers today. He had 223 at-bats in that streak, five strikeouts. Five. He struck out 13 times all year. A guy strike out 13 times in a weekend now, and he did it just 13 times all year. Ted Williams that year, 1941, he had 406. He did not win the MVP. DiMaggio won the MVP that year, and it wasn't actually the longest streak of DiMaggio's career, because in the Pacific Coast League, when he played for the San Francisco Seals, he had a streak of 61 games in 1933. The only two players who have really knocked on the door of this, and they're a long way away. Pete Rose in 1978 hitting 44 consecutive games, so he was still 12 away from tying. And Paul Molitor hitting 39 consecutive games in 1987. Those are the only two players of the modern era to get within, I don't even call it striking distance, of DiMaggio. I mean, you think about that. The streaks that we talk about in sports, most notably Cal Ripken, which is, you know, unbelievable, coming to work every day for 15 years and never missing a game. That's incredible. But DiMaggio coming to work every day and excelling every day. Remember this, if you are a really good hitter in Major League Baseball, you fail 7 out of 10 times. So if you're playing in a game, you're going to get a maximum of 5 at-bats, maybe, right? 5 at-bats. So if you get one hit, you're right there, and you're doing it every day. You're doing it every single day, and right before the streak was stopped, he had 3 hits, including a home run, but it was eventually stopped, and he is considered to be among, if not the greatest hitter of all time. Ted Williams would say he's the greatest hitter of all time, and maybe he was, but DiMaggio was awfully close, and what a performance he had in 1941, and there are certain numbers in sports that you talk about. You used to talk about 715 breaking Babe Ruth's record. Now it'd be 755 for Hank Aaron. 762 is what Barry Bonds hit, but it's tainted. And, what other number stands out besides 56 like that? If you say 56, everybody knows what you're talking about. And 80 years ago today, Joe DiMaggio made it 56 consecutive games. This popped up yesterday out of nowhere. The president of the NCAA, Mark Emmert, had a news conference, and he said it's time to consider a decentralized and deregulated version of college sports. Translation, the NCAA ain't dead, but it's dying. It's going out. 30-minute interview, small group of reporters. He stressed that he was not putting forth a mandate or even a recommendation, but he laid out a vision for the future of college sports that puts fewer limitations on athletes and de-emphasizes the role of a national governing body. So he is an empty suit who makes $2.7 million a year. He's been a completely ineffective leader for the NCAA, everything, including that billion-dollar contract that they have for the NCAA basketball tournament that he maybe gets credit for negotiating. I read a story in Sports Business Journal that he left millions, if not billions, on the table in the deal. If you look at what's happening in sports television and how sponsors are running to get their ads on live televised sports, and the NCAA tournament is huge, mainly because of the office pool that everybody plays that and wants to watch teams that they haven't watched all year. It just works. It works for them. And so they have something there that's gold. And he negotiated a deal which sounds great on paper, but really isn't. Just to tie this in, I saw this morning, that NBC has sold out most of its inventory for the Super Bowl. The Super Bowl is not until February. They have sold out 85%, and they are getting between $5.8 million and $6.2 million for a 30-second spot. So, yeah, it's the Super Bowl. It's the biggest game and the biggest sport. I get that. But there's money to be had, and Mark Emmert hasn't negotiated that kind of a deal. NBC has pressed advertisers who want to air commercials on the Super Bowl that they have to get involved in the Winter Olympics too. So they're using it as leverage for their other programming as well. Now, last year, CBS had the Super Bowl, and there was a lot of uncertainty because of the pandemic, and they did sell out the game, but they got a lot less, $5.5 million for a 30-second spot, and they didn't sell out till a couple of weeks before the game. And some of the traditional advertisers that pulled out, Coca-Cola, Hyundai, Ford, Pepsi, Anheuser-Busch, they were all out, and now they're back and competing for spots. But the point being is that Emmert has done a terrible job at his job. And you remember this with this Sandusky case 10 years ago at Penn State. They didn't do any investigating on their own. They just looked at the Louis Free report, and they said, yeah, this will do. That's fine. This is what we're going to do. And he's saying, and he's right about this. He says, we need to be ready to say, you know, for field hockey is different than football, wrestling is different than lacrosse, and not get so hung up on having everything be the same. Exactly. Because it ain't the same. It's big business in college football. It's big business in college basketball. And he's indicating that you need to let the conferences run things themselves. And now that you have name, image, and likeness, where players can get deals and make lots of money off the court and off the field, you don't need the NCAA. This governing body, as they called it, has stood up for a long time and has operated in a dictatorial way. That's not going to be the case anymore. And what Mark Emmert basically did yesterday, I mean, I guess he's in his 60s. He doesn't care. But he basically told everybody, my job is superfluous. I don't really have a purpose here anymore. And the NCAA really doesn't have the purpose that it used to have. You know, they maybe can be part of sanctioning certain events, but you know, what do they govern now? It used to be that they were looking out for cheaters and, you know, people who did things that were not in line with the rule books, and there'd be suspensions and things like that. Not anymore. And it was sort of arbitrary too. You know, who got caught, who didn't get caught. You know, the story that John Feinstein likes to tell all the time is when Jerry Tarkanian, who did a lot of cheating himself at UNLV and Fresno State, found out that Kentucky got caught because a recruit was sent cash in a FedEx envelope. He said, oh boy, now they're going to drop the hammer on Cleveland State. And yeah, there's a lot of truth to that. That's how the NCAA operated. The big boys skated on a lot of things, and they lower the hammer on smaller programs. And for Emmert to say these things, I mean, I guess it's pretty much known. But here's an organization that was founded 115 years ago, and has operated with pretty much the same rules. They're completely outdated now. And it oversees 450,000 students who play sports. The majority of those are in non-revenue sports. So that's what they need to govern right now. Football and basketball, forget it. That's the big leagues. That's over. Hands off. Let the conferences, let the individual schools handle it. And the NCAA and its useless commissioner in Mark Emmert can say, bye-bye. We're not involved anymore. Coming up, we'll get to Trey Mancini's conversation with Dan Patrick yesterday as he recovers from cancer. Also, what Cam Newton said on our morning show and much more as we roll into the Tony Kornheiser Show next on ESPN 630.